Traditional revenue sources for public media and media at large are declining this year, and we at Marketplace are not immune to those trends. We're currently tracking behind target for this budget year. We're tightening up our expenses, yes, but the need for trusted, grounded, fact-based reporting is as pressing as ever, and we simply cannot cut back on our mission. So we're turning to the listeners like you. Please step up now and invest in Marketplace. If you haven't given yet, now's the time. Go to marketplace.org/donate. The week that was, of course, because it's Friday. We'll talk about measuring this economy as well, and then artificial intelligence and the law. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 23rd day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There was, if you ask me, just a hint of an early summer slowdown in economic news this week, punctuated, it should be said, by a couple of highlights. So discuss them, we will. Catherine Rampell's at the Washington Post, Gina Smilex at the New York Times. Hey, you too.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So let's see. Catherine, I want to start with you. And I want to start with Chair Powell on the Hill this week for 2 days of testimony. And here's what I want to ask you. It seems to me that he keeps saying the same thing over and over and over again, and yet nobody is really listening. Do you suppose he feels like he's banging his head against the wall?
Perhaps. I wouldn't blame him if he feels a little bit frustrated right now. The Fed is trying to walk a very fine line, right? They don't want to tip the economy into recession, but they want to stamp out inflation. And convincing the public, markets, lawmakers, consumers, et cetera, that they will get that balance right, I think is really challenging. So Chair Powell keeps saying, look, we are going to keep raising interest rates. Mm-hmm. Just because we paused recently doesn't mean that you should read into that we are done with the fight against inflation. And that's sort of what he would, you know, the ideal scenario is one where they actually don't have to raise rates that much, but markets think they will. You know, because then that can do the work of rate hikes for them, essentially. But that's not where we are. We're sort of in the other scenario where he keeps saying we're going to raise rates more and markets don't believe it.
Right. So Gina, the note I have for this next question says, why is inflation? And clearly I got interrupted when I was writing myself that note. So I'm going to wing it here. I'm going to ask you this. Why is inflation, number one, going down so fast the past like 6 months, but now seems to be taking so long to go down, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, so I think it's kind of a two-track story with inflation. You know, you've got this one track, which is headline inflation, which is the one that includes food prices and energy prices, so gas, fuel, et cetera. And that one is coming down really fast. It peaked at 9% last summer. It's down to 4% now. You know, very rapid decline. And if you look at a chart, it looks like a good, pretty steady decline there. If you look at a chart of our other favorite inflation indicator, though, which is core inflation, which strips out those food and fuel prices because they can be pretty volatile, it does not look that encouraging. It's kind of, you know, it started to come down and then it kind of flatlined and now it's just kind of moving sideways. And so I think that's the real problem. You know, the underlying inflation pressures in the economy, the ones that don't jump around a lot for sort of these one-off reasons, those inflation pressures are just lasting pretty stubbornly. And a lot of that is a story about service prices. A lot of it's a story about, you know, things that are heavily dependent on wage growth. And so, you know, that I think is what has the Fed so worried. And that's why they don't feel like they can just declare victory yet.
Yeah, let's just get the plug in here. If you want to hear Gina talking about this at length, there's another podcast out there whose initials are The Daily that she was on earlier this week, which, you know, Gina for a half an hour on this stuff is good stuff. Catherine Rampell, let me ask you this. Were you alluding to a moment ago the possibility, the chance, the maybe kind of sorta of a soft landing, maybe?
It certainly looks more likely than I had thought a few months ago. And if you look at surveys of Wall Street economists, they have also gotten a little more optimistic that we can skate by without a recession. It's not for certain. I mean, I certainly, at the very least, the fact that we did not default on our debt.
sorry to laugh, you know, but it's crazy that we're that's yay, we did it, you know?
I know, but that was one of the reasons I was so worried independent of whatever the Fed does, there was this looming risk of economic catastrophe that is now taken off the table. Now, the question is, does the Fed have the path of rate hikes right? And as we've been discussing, it's really hard to know. I think they have a very difficult set of choices ahead of them, again, because financial markets are showing or have shown some signs of fragility. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to raise rates any more than they have to, lest there be more fallout from that in the commercial real estate market, for example, among other rate-sensitive sectors. And yet they don't want to declare victory, as Gina said, in the war on inflation. So the soft landing would be the ideal situation. I don't know that it will definitely happen. It would be great if it did, but I'm more optimistic than I was a few months ago.
Gina, what do you make of the news, I guess it was yesterday, of so many other central banks going ahead with their rate hikes, right? The Bank of England, the Bank of Turkey, for crying out loud, and Norway. I mean, everybody else is like, pause, skip, what the? No, we're raising.
Yeah, and even the people who did skip are like, it was legitimately a skip, guys. We're back in action. Right. We're raising rates again. The RBA and the Bank of Canada have both raised rates again. And so I think, you know, the takeaway here is that everyone is battling the same problem simultaneously. Yep. Like, we're not the only ones with this sticky inflation. It's a feature throughout the world. And actually, in some places, it looks even worse than here. Like, the Bank of England is contending with this really serious inflation problem. It is so stubborn over there. And part of that's because they're more exposed to Ukraine, but also part of that is just because their wage, you know, the pass-through from wages looks, which, you know, sort of this idea that wages can push up inflation does look a little bit more intense over there. And so you've got, you know, a real sort of world of inflation problems here. And so that's going to be an interesting theme to keep an eye on.
It sort of feels, Catherine, like we're just waiting for the other shoe to drop. But we've been waiting for the other shoe to drop for like a year and a half now.
Yes. The earliest recession calls or recession forecasts, I should say, came in about a year ago or more. And if you look at, again, if you look at the surveys of Wall Street economists or, you know, various other metrics looking at the probability of recession, they have been elevated for a while and have recently been coming down, depending on which metric you're looking at. But we have been hearing about this recession around the corner for many, many months. And it's not clear if the forecasts all along were just overly pessimistic, that everybody was sort of underestimating the strength of the U.S. economy, to the extent we're talking about, you know, the domestic situation, or they were just early. Right? That would be a much worse scenario, that maybe we haven't seen the full effects of the Fed's rate hikes and tightening financial conditions. So maybe they were right. We will eventually have a recession due to this rate hiking cycle, but we just haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. Gina, we're going to go out on a little bit of a lighter side thing here. Chair Powell showed a little personality this week up on the Hill. There was the whole Grateful Dead thing, which we talked about on this show, like on Wednesday. And then he was talking about members' dogs. I mean, he seems comfortable in what he's doing.
Right? He told a senator that to remind his dog that he's a good boy. So he did seem fairly comfortable there. Yeah. Yeah. And he informed us all that he's been a Grateful Dead fan for 50 years. So, you know, I think he seems to be managing to keep some levity in his life, even as he goes through a pretty intense inflationary period.
He is indeed. Gina Smilek at the New York Times and Catherine Rempel at the Washington Post. 2 weeks in a row. Thank you, too, for picking up the phone 2 weeks in a row. We appreciate it.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks, guys.
You too. Wall Street to end this week. Well, it's going to be the sad music. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are days, of which this is one, where what seems like maybe not great economic news turns out to be not great at all. We learned this morning the manufacturing sector contracted in June. The data is from S&P Global Market Intelligence, which says, actually, that manufacturing shrank at an even faster rate in June than it did in May. You might have heard here or elsewhere that manufacturing has been under pressure as consumers have been spending less on goods and more on services. But to repeat myself, that is not necessarily a bad sign about the economy overall. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
S&P Global's report says the manufacturing sector shrank because their customers aren't placing as many new orders. S&P Global's chief business economist, Chris Williamson, says that weaker demand can lead to other problems down the road.
Companies adjusting their output levels, adjusting their employment levels and inventory levels and so forth. Everything stems from that change in new order flows.
It's not just the manufacturing sector that's looking downbeat. Justyna Jabinska-LaMonica is a senior manager at the Conference Board, a research company. She says consumer expectations are falling. Credit is harder to come by. She manages an index of leading economic indicators, and this week it fell for the 14th month in a row.
We only had situations like that happening, the most recent during the Great Recession of 2008.
Thing is, Jabinska-LaMonica says that's not the situation today. Companies are still scrambling to find workers. Wages are rising. In fact, she just had to revise her prediction for this quarter's economic growth from negative to positive. I asked her if she finds the whole economic forecasting business frustrating right now.
It's not frustration. I wouldn't call it frustration. I think that it's challenging.
Either way, she says nobody should be frustrated that the economy is doing better than she and other economists expected. And those downbeat indicators don't tell the whole story. Justin Wolfers, an economics professor at the University of Michigan, says take consumers. They might say they're pessimistic about the economy.
But if you look at what they do, consumers are out there spending like they've never spent before.
Wolfers says it's true that some sectors of the economy are slowing down, but there just aren't enough of them to be concerned.
If you move beyond the vibes and look at the hard data, we're creating jobs at a gangbusters pace. Unemployment is at a 50-year low. This ain't a recession, man.
Wolfers says the best way to predict the trajectory of the economy is to look at how the economy's doing right now. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Fact is, there are all kinds of measurements of this economy. National, see also Justin's story on leading economic indicators. And regional, data from the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas not too long ago, just for instance, that paints a pretty nice picture of the Houston economy. Job growth and a better than 4% increase in real hourly earnings. The thing about all this measuring, though, is that it works both ways. A new report from the United Way finds an increase in the number of Houston-area households that are struggling to afford basic necessities. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall has our story on how the economy's working for the working class.
Affordability has been a long-time selling point for people willing to brave the Houston heat, humidity, and highways, says Dan Potter with Rice University.
Houston as a historically affordable place to live, where you can roll in here and work hard and you could have a middle-class life.
But in an annual survey of Houstonians, Potter recently found some of the lowest levels of optimism about the economy since the 80s.
You start to see some of the cracks in the armor there.
Potter says things are especially tough for folks without a high school diploma. He blames inflation, especially housing costs. Two-thirds of locals could afford to buy a median-priced home a decade ago, compared to a third today. Daisy Morales runs AMA charter schools, which serve low-income Houstonians. She says students and their families are struggling with housing.
They're all starting to, you know, live together, add more family or individuals to one, you know, family unit, moving into less and less desirable areas.
Reverend Ed Gomez has seen a similar trend while doing outreach at St. Paul's Episcopal Church.
These are not people that are unemployed. These are people that are working service jobs, landscaping, all sorts of janitorial jobs, cafeteria jobs, usually food industry.
He says his church has had to turn away around 40 cars of families a week from its food drive. This is as evictions in Harris County have surged far beyond the pre-pandemic average, per data from Princeton University's Eviction Lab. Lone Star Legal Aid's Eric Quatler.
We are absolutely seeing an uptick in evictions from landlords who want to raise rents on people who are locked into lower rates.
He says many families are dealing with deaths or other crises and get behind on bills. When landlords take them to court, it can make it even harder to get future housing. In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Dear AI, read through this case file.
What could possibly go wrong? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 219 points today. Sounds like a lot. It is 0.6% because the index is at 33,727. That's why. The NASDAQ dropped 138 points. That is 1% on that particular index, 13,492. The S&P 500 down 33 points, almost 0.8%, 43.48 there. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow off 1.6%. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500 both down about 1.4%. We heard from Justin Ho that among other economic indicators, manufacturing declined this month. So in manufacturing stocks, Myers Industries shed 2.8%. Omega Flex, they make metal hoses, up 0.5%. Highway Holdings slowed 0.8%. Used car dealer CarMax announced a second consecutive drop in sales this quarter. That's even though average prices fell $1,600 per unit, down by about 5.5% from a year ago. Even so, CarMax shares sped up 10%. 3,500 Starbucks employees in more than 150 locations across the country promised to go on strike over the next week. That's over employee claims that Starbucks was not allowing pride in some of its stores. Starbucks dipped 2.5% today, almost. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. $9.2 billion is today's government expenditure line item. Technically, it's a loan, low interest, to be sure, to the Ford Motor Company and its South Korean partner, a company called SK On, to build three new EV battery factories, one in Tennessee and two in Kentucky. Those batteries will eventually wind up in Ford and Lincoln electric cars and trucks. And it should be pointed out that this is the biggest loan yet in the Biden administration's push to promote renewable energy and, oh, not coincidentally, build homegrown EV production capacity while they're at it. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one.
There's a lot of public investment going to build electric battery megafactories in the Upper South, specifically Kentucky and Tennessee. I asked Ned Hill at Ohio State's Manufacturing Institute why.
Battery plants are very large. Making batteries with cutting-edge digital equipment is a big user of electricity.
And the Tennessee Valley Authority has some pretty cheap power. Also, says Hill,
batteries are big, and these suckers are heavy, so they don't want to truck them a long way.
The region's already a hub for car and truck assembly.
Put together cost of electricity, availability of land, just-in-time delivery constraints, and that puts the thumb on the scale.
Plus, labor in the region is relatively cheap, and so far it's proven hard to organize unions there. The investment means 7,500 new battery-making jobs and more in support industries. Michael Gritton at Kentuckiana Works, the workforce development agency in Louisville, says in addition to having a trained workforce,
we can reach almost everyone within a day's drive who lives east of the Rockies. We're in that logistical center of the country.
Which China is definitely not. And, says Columbia climate economist Gernot Wagner,
China, for better or worse, is producing the vast, vast majority of batteries as we speak. Well over two-thirds of all lithium-ion batteries currently sold globally are produced in China.
Wagner says the Biden administration is pumping billions into domestic EV production to try and keep any more of that high-value business from going to China and to prevent China from further consolidating its dominance of EV manufacturing and technology worldwide. And Wagner points out the U.S. government is lending, not giving, money to the industry. If all goes well, it'll be paid back with interest. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We seem to have arrived at the point with artificial intelligence where everything feels simultaneously amazing and slightly terrifying. That varies, of course, with which particular AI capabilities you're interested in. For us today, it's law and the business thereof. On the amazing side, GPT-4, which is the large language model that powers ChatGPT, it took the bar exam earlier this year. And for the lawyers among you still traumatized by the bar exam, it was a breeze for generative AI. GPT-4 scored in the 90th percentile. On the terrifying side, the lawyer who filed a brief in federal court written by ChatGPT that wound up being full of fake cases and citations that ChatGPT just made up. Marketplace's Matt Levin is on the AI beat for us. And today, the first of two parts on the promise and the peril of how AI could change the business of law as we know it. The promise is up first.
For all the doom and gloom about AI, Michael Szymanczyk has a pretty compelling use case for the upside.
Figure out how we can take the 16.5-year average of a wrongfully convicted person sitting in prison and bring that down to something closer to maybe 4 years.
Szymanczyk is managing attorney at the California Innocence Project, a nonprofit that freed 40 wrongfully incarcerated people, some serving life sentences.
We have six lawyers. A couple of our lawyers are actually sharing offices, and we are on a shoestring budget.
Szymanczyk says his office gets about 800 requests for help every year, along with 4,000 pieces of mail his interns have to sort through. Paralegals are costly, which is why when a company asked him if he wanted to pilot a new AI legal assistant, he tested it out with a case the Innocence Project has already wrapped up.
Dear AI, read through this case file. Several hundred pages of police reports and transcripts. Tell me, is this victim witness consistent in their identification of my client?
He says a human attorney would take about a month to do all that. The AI?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. Szymanczyk says a lot of the reason it takes so long to exonerate his clients isn't the appeals process. It's this type of grunt work. He's already using AI for a murder case he's currently working on.
We're getting to the point where lawyers have a duty to use AI.
There's already a bevy of AI products specifically tailored for law firms. Legal databases like LexisNexis and Westlaw have AI-branded offerings. Jake Heller is CEO of CaseText. His company makes CoCounsel, the AI that the California Innocence Project is using. For for-profit law firms, it's $500 per user per month. The first question he often gets from attorneys is, your AI just going to make stuff up?
We ground everything it says in real documents, real databases, real information, so that there aren't chances for it to hallucinate or make up answers to questions.
Legal AI tools can summarize thousands of emails or texts for document review, recommend questions for depositions, and write incredibly technical legal research memos. All of that should translate to fewer billable hours and cheaper legal services. Emphasis on should.
The objective of particularly the larger law firms is to keep the money train going. And so how do you do that? They'll figure out how.
Attorney Sharon Nelson is a technology consultant for law firms. She started her career in the 70s and says she's seen some of this movie before.
You know, when we got computerized, everybody said it would reduce bills. Didn't work. Did not work. And pretty sure this one isn't going to work either.
But when Microsoft Word first came out in the 90s, it couldn't write a letter to opposing counsel for you or obey commands like this.
It's okay, now make the letter more aggressive. Threaten them with, you know, sanctions or whatever.
Evan Shankman is chief innovation officer for Fisher Phillips, a national employment law firm that is an early adopter of legal AI. He says lawyers and paralegals have so far given the AI rave reviews. They mostly use it as a starting point for legal research, and then the humans take over. No one has accused Shankman yet of trying to replace them with a robot. And there's just some very human lawyer things that CoCounsel isn't great at. Have you heard a good AI lawyer joke yet?
I have not, but maybe I'll ask CoCounsel.
Shankman didn't think it could come up with one, but sure enough, after we asked it...
Why did the AI lawyer refuse to take on a new case? Because it didn't compute.
Probably best to leave the lawyer jokes to Comedy GPT whenever that comes out. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, just to put a punctuation mark on Matt's story. I mentioned that lawyer who'd filed a brief in federal court written by ChatGPT, complete with fake citations and all. Yeah, that didn't go so well. This week, the judge in whose court the brief was filed fined the lawyer and his associate $5,000 and made them write notes of apology to all the real-life judges that ChatGPT connected to all those fake cases. All right, we are going. Here is your moment of economic context, which comes with my now standard caveat. Would you take your paycheck in Bitcoin? I ask because the original cryptocurrency is on a run, up 20% this week, but only, and I stress here only, because a couple of financial firms have come up with new ways to trade the thing. Again, I ask, paycheck, would you? Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.